Have you ever wondered what happens when a war ends and the winners realize the losers were building airplanes 20 years ahead of anything they had? I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one is a doozy. 81 years ago today, on May 9, 1945, the Soviet Union declared Victory Day. The shooting had stopped across Europe, but for a small band of American test pilots, the real mission was just getting started. They were racing across the wreckage of Germany in jeeps and stolen staff cars, hunting for airplanes. Not just any airplanes, jets, rocket planes, flying wings, machines that made anything in the American inventory look like it belonged in a museum. The operation had a name that sounds like it came from a dime novel. They called it LUSTY, L-U-S-T-Y, stood for Luftwaffe Secret Technology and the Man. Running the show was a colonel named Harold Watson, a no-nonsense test pilot who'd been flying everything the Army Air Forces could throw at him since before Pearl Harbor. His team got a nickname too, Watson's Whizzers, a bunch of fighter jocks and engineers given one simple order: find the German jets, get them running, fly them out before the Soviets or the British or the French get their hands on them. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now, to understand why Watson's Whizzers were in such a hurry, you have to understand what the Allies found when they started rolling through Germany in the spring of 45. It was staggering. The Germans had been flying operational jet fighters since the summer of 1944. The Messerschmitt Me-262. Twin-engine swept wings faster than anything the Americans or British had in the air by at least 100 miles an hour. And that wasn't even the most exotic thing in the German hangars. There was the Arado R-234 Blitz, world's first operational jet bomber. It could fly reconnaissance missions so fast and so high that Allied fighters couldn't catch it. There was the Heinkel He-162 Volksjäger, the people's fighter, a tiny single-engine jet they were building out of plywood and glue because they'd run out of aluminum. There was the Horten Ho-229, a flying wing jet that looked like it had been designed in 1990 instead of 1944. There were rocket interceptors, guided missiles, things that gave the intelligence people nightmares. The problem was, this stuff was scattered across what was left of the Third Reich, in bomb-cratered factories, in salt mines, in barns, in the Black Forest, hidden under camouflage netting on country roads. And the clock was ticking because the occupation zones were about to be drawn, and anything in what would become the Soviet zone was going to disappear behind the Iron Curtain. Colonel Watson handpicked his team, about a dozen pilots, and a larger group of mechanics and intelligence officers. These were not ordinary pilots. Every one of them was a test pilot or a combat veteran with the kind of hands-on mechanical sense you needed when you were about to climb into an airplane you'd never seen before, with instruments labeled in German, powered by engines that might have been assembled by slave labor in an underground factory. Now here's where it gets interesting. They didn't have manuals, they didn't have instructors. When Watson's men found an Me-262 sitting in a revetment at an airfield outside Munich, they had to figure out how to start the thing by trial and error. Those early Junkers Jumo 004 turbojet engines were notoriously temperamental. You had to bring them up to speed slowly or they'd flame out, push them too hard on startup, and the turbine blades would overheat and warp. Let them idle too long and unburned fuel would pool in the tailpipe, and you'd get a torch fire that could melt the tail section right off the airplane. The mechanics were absolute wizards. They scrounged fuel from captured dumps. They pulled parts off wrecked airframes to fix the ones that were almost flyable. One crew spent 3 days hand-fabricating a fuel line from copper tubing they found in a bombed-out plumbing shop. They cannibalized tires from German staff cars. They topped off hydraulic systems with whatever fluid they could find that was close enough in viscosity to work. And then Watson's pilots climbed in and flew. Think about that for a second. No type rating, no checkout ride with an instructor in the right seat, no simulator time. You're a propeller pilot your whole career, and now you're sitting in a cockpit that has no propeller. The sound is different. Everything about a jet is different. There's no torque effect on takeoff. The acceleration is slow at first, then it builds and builds. The engine doesn't respond instantly when you move the throttle like a piston engine does. There's a lag, spool-up time. If you're used to a Mustang or a Thunderbolt, that lag can kill you because you're behind the airplane and you don't even know it. Bob Ansbach was one of Watson's pilots. He climbed into an Me-262 at Lechfeld Airfield in Bavaria, taxied out onto a runway that had been patched with rubble and packed earth after Allied bombing, pushed the throttles forward, and took off in an airplane that no American had any business flying. He said afterward that the thing was a revelation, smooth, fast, quiet in a way that felt alien, no vibration from a spinning propeller, just the whistle of the jets and the hiss of air over that beautiful swept wing. They flew the captured jets to collection points, airfield to airfield across occupied Germany and into France. Each flight was an adventure because these airplanes had been maintained by an air force that was falling apart. Engines had unknown hours on them. Fuel was whatever the Germans had been using, which by late in the war was a synthetic blend that varied wildly in quality, from batch to batch. The landing gear on some of these machines was held together with wire and prayer. One pilot had a flameout at altitude in a Heinkel 162 and dead-sticked it onto a grass field. Another blew a tire on landing in an Arado 234 and ground-looped into a ditch. Nobody got killed, which is frankly miraculous when you consider what they were doing. The final destination was Cherbourg, France, on the coast of the English Channel. Watson's team collected about 40 aircraft in total, Mi-262s, Arado 234s, Heinkel 162s, a Focke-Wulf Ta 152, which was one of the finest piston engine fighters Germany ever built, with a top speed that embarrassed most of what we had, a Dornier Du 335 Fail, the Arrow, a push-pull twin-engine fighter with a propeller on the nose and a propeller on the tail, one of the fastest piston aircraft ever flown. They crated some of them, they partially disassembled others, and they loaded the whole lot onto the British escort carrier HMS Reaper. There's an irony in that name that Watson probably appreciated. The Reaper sailed for Newark, New Jersey, arriving in mid-July of 1945. The airplanes were offloaded, sent to Wright Field in Ohio, and put through exhaustive flight testing. What they learned changed everything. American engineers had been working on jet engines, sure. The Bell P-59 Ericomet had flown in 42, and the Lockheed P-80 Shooting Star was coming along, but the German engineering was different. The swept wing on the Mi-262, the axial flow compressor design, the way they'd integrated the engines into the airframe. These weren't just interesting, they were a roadmap. The North American F-86 Sabre, the airplane that would dominate the skies over Korea, just 5 years later, owed its swept wing directly to German research data captured in operations like Lusty. Boeing's engineers studied German swept-wing data when they were designing what became the B-47 Stratojet, the bomber that was the backbone of Strategic Air Command. The influence rippled forward through decades of American aviation. And here's the part that doesn't get talked about enough. Watson's whizzers weren't the only ones hunting. The British had their own teams, so did the French. And the Soviets were ruthlessly efficient. They captured entire factories. They took engineers, they took blueprints. The Soviets' first operational jet fighter, the MiG-9, flew just months after the war ended, powered by reverse-engineered German engines. The MiG-15 that American pilots would face over Korea in 1950 was a direct descendant of German wartime research. So, in a very real sense, the race across Germany in the spring of 45 wasn't just about collecting souvenirs. It was the opening move of the Cold War. The jets that Watson's whizzers grabbed off those cratered airfields helped shape American air superiority for a generation. Some of those captured airplanes survive today. You can see an Epini Mi-262 at the National Air and Space Museum. There's a beautifully restored Arado 234 at the Udvar Hazy Center. The Hordenho 229 is there too, unrestored, sitting in the conservation hangar with its plywood skin peeling and its jet intake staring at you like empty eye sockets. Every time I see it, I think about the Watson's Whizzers mechanic who probably kicked its tires in some Bavarian field and said something like, "What in the world were they building here?" Watson himself went on to a distinguished career, retired as a major general. But the men who were with him in those wild weeks of May and June 1945, they all said the same thing. Nothing they did before or after compared to climbing into an enemy jet that nobody fully understood and flying it across a continent that was still smoldering. That story came from several sources, primarily Jeff Ethel and Alfred Price's work on captured German aircraft, and the Air Force Historical Archives on Operation Lusty. You can find more at radiohangar.com. That's all for today on The Hangar. Fly safe, and if somebody ever asks you to start an engine with no manual, at least make sure it's pointing the right direction.